Hey Trailblazers, we have some exciting news here at the Trailblazing Texas podcast. We have partnered up with Hilltop Packs, not just because they make amazing ultralight gear, but because they're a small family-run business doing huge things for our hiking and backpacking community. Every food bag, dry sack, fanny pack that you order can be completely customized. Print your trail name, your dog's face, your favorite mountain, or really whatever inspires you. When you shop at Hilltop Packs, you're not only buying gear that you're absolutely going to love, but you're supporting real families, real jobs, and small town craftsmanship. So head over to hilltoppacks.com and use code TTP10 to get 10% off of your order. Now on with the episode. Welcome to the Trailblazing Texas podcast, where we embark on a journey through our diverse Texas landscapes and breathtaking trails while always engaging with our amazing Texas hiking community. So settle in, tighten up those bootlaces, and get ready for the thrilling tales awaiting for you on this episode. Welcome to the Trailblazing Texas podcast. I'm your host, Jason. And today I'm excited to have coming to us all the way from Mission Tejas State Park, one of my favorite state parks. We have Interpretive Ranger Noah. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be on here. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Noah, I'm sorry to do this to you, but I don't know if you've heard any of the previous episodes. But for golly, about the last 3 to 4 months, we have a lightning round. The listeners love it. So these are questions that you have not seen. And I promise they're not hard, but just fast answers, whatever the first words that pop to your mind. Are you ready for this?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Favorite trail in the park?
That would be Hardwood Trail.
One word that best describes Mission Tejas State Park.
Storied.
What is your favorite activity to do in the park?
I like to go bird watching, particularly around the Navadachi Prairie. It's a pretty big open area. You can see a few raptors out there. It's pretty good.
Funniest thing you've ever overheard a visitor say?
Oh boy. Where do I start? wasn't at this park, but I did have, I was cleaning a restroom at a different state park, and I had a visitor run up to me asking me if we had thieves in the park. And I said, ma'am, did someone take your stuff? She goes, I left out some double stuffed Oreos last night. And I instantly knew. I said, ma'am, that's called raccoons. Yep. She goes, you have raccoons out here? I said, where are you from, ma'am? She said, the city she was from. I said, you have raccoons in your backyard. Guarantee you.
Absolutely. Favorite time in the park, sunrise or sunset?
Sunset.
All right. What's tougher to manage, the heat or the crowds?
Well, lately it's been the heat. We haven't had too many crowds. As of now, we're still closed, but I would rather deal with crowds than the heat.
What is your go-to trail snack?
Oh, I got an interesting one. M&M's.
All right. Coolest animal you've ever spotted at the park?
The bald eagles out here. We have some bald eagles that hang out in the area. It's really cool to see them fly over and making their calls.
Most important thing first-time visitors coming to the park must know before arriving?
Cell signal can be very spotty in some areas, particularly in the lower parts of the park.
Yes or no? Have you ever answered a visitor's question that made you pause and think, did they really just ask that?
Yes.
All right. What part of the park do you hope never changes?
Wow, that's a really good question. I guess I would say I just hope that our historical landmarks will make it through the test of time as they have for the last several decades or even centuries in some cases.
All right. So let's say you guys got the approval and you hired another park ranger and today's their first day. What is one piece of advice that you would tell them?
Watch where you step, particularly around this time of year. Snakes are pretty active this time of year.
So, Nikki with Lake Brownwood State Park, we had the same answer to this question. What is a trail snack that you pretend to like, but you secretly hate? And I'm going to give you my example while you're thinking. So mine is beef jerky. I love beef jerky. I just don't want it on a trail. And for sure, everybody that I hike and backpack with, everybody has beef jerky. And, you know, of course, hey, you want some beef jerky? You want some beef jerky? And, you know, I just smile and go, yeah, okay. But yeah, I don't want to eat it on the trail.
Honestly, I may have to go with that too. It's, I love having it for road trips, but when you're hiking on the trail, just, I don't know what it is, if it's the chewing or the salt of it. I think it's the chewing for me. It's like, it's not quite, it feels, I don't know how a snack can feel unintuitive on a hike, but for me personally, it seems to attain that status somehow.
All right. Would you rather clean park restrooms after a busy holiday weekend or lead a group of 20 unsupervised fifth graders on a hike?
The group on the hike. Absolutely. I've done both. I know which one I prefer.
All right. Last question. Are you ready? This is the most important question on the podcast. This will dictate the duration and the direction we go with the podcast. What is your favorite of all times Texas hiking podcast that you've been a guest on?
Well, I mean, I don't know. There's been so many. The Trailblazing Texas podcast.
Ah, no, I love it. You know, I've been asking that question, golly, for 4 or 5 months, and I'm batting 1,000. I love it. As a host, it warms my heart. All right, second most important question. Before we dive into the episode, getting to know you a little bit better, as well as Mission Tejas, how is the heat and how are the mosquitoes at the park?
I guess it depends on what time of year we're talking about. As of now, the heat actually has been dissipating a bit. For the first time in over a month, we've actually had some weather pass through, so temperatures kind of went down a little bit. Mosquitoes, they're absolutely a presence here, although me personally, I feel like a more present nuisance insect, or at least an insect species that can be a nuisance for hikers and campers, are the big black horseflies.
Oh, preach, Noah, preach.
Yeah, we do have quite a bit of black horseflies out here, particularly around hardwood and the lower areas of Steep Ravine Trail. It's going down there anytime after 8 a.m. in the summer. They're gonna start swarming you. They're going to check you out.
I absolutely hate the horseflies, and that's really the main reason why I don't hike in the summer. And I'm with the new – so you're the second podcast episode that I've had in the new studio, so that's awesome. But now I'm about 25 – I was about an hour from both endpoints of the longest trail in Texas, the Lone Star Hiking Trail. Now I'm about 25 minutes from Trailhead 1, which is awesome. And, man, those horseflies – it is absolutely horrible. And even when my hiking season usually starts about first weekend in May, and I try to push into June, depending on if I can catch some cool days or if I can mitigate it by going at night or in the morning. But yeah, that's really the main reason why I don't hike in the summer. It's just they're horrible. So yeah. So to the listeners, just, you know, get there and get all your stuff done before 8, because then the horse flies are going to get you.
It's been a lot better lately.
Yeah. All right. So as we start to move into the episode, I love this section of the episode as well as the listeners, but it's really to get to know you a little bit more. And so first question for you is, how long have you worked for Texas Parks and Wildlife?
I'd say since around June of 2021.
So how long have you been at Mission Tejas?
I started here around November of 2023.
So this is probably one of my favorite questions. And it's funny that all the interpretive rangers, all the superintendents that have come on, they all have the same answer. So what does a typical day look like for you at the park?
Well, let me preface that by saying this. We are a smaller site. We have a smaller crew here. Everyone does the absolute best that they can. I have to wear quite a few hats in my job because I also help with some of the maintenance work out here. Usually my days almost always inevitably start off with checking bathrooms. And a lot of times you can kind of tell how the day's going to go based on what you find.
Yeah.
some people have a superstition about how does January 1st go and how does that say how the rest of the year is going to go. I go, all right, day use restrooms. Here we go. How's my day going to go? Open the door. I have my answer.
Yep. I hear you.
But it can be different things each day. It can be everywhere from doing camp checks. There's a lot of monitoring the trails. Mostly these days, it's leaf blowing. Every time we get a slight gust out here, all the trails need to be blown off again. Mm-hmm. It's just a mix of field or interpretive work. Sometimes if I'm out on the trails, I'm always looking for excellent flowers, any kind of wildlife out there to post to the park social media. Could be sometimes we may even be doing burn prep as the winter starts to come along. I could be up here in the office around the weekends. I'll be in the visitor center just kind of researching new ideas for programs coming up and interacting with visitors. A lot of times if I'm out on the trails and people, have a question about like, hey, we saw this scat on the trail, is one question I get asked a lot. Someone sees some scat on the trail. They keep asking, is this a bear? Is this a bear? And I'm like, no, that's a coyote.
Yep. So what inspired you to get into park work?
Well, I've always enjoyed the outdoors. I particularly have always had, ever since I was a child, I've always had an interest in animals and wildlife. I mean, obviously, it started off loving dinosaurs as a little kid. And then as I grew up, that interest just kind of expanded to include wildlife in general. I do still like my dinos, though. But after college, I knew I wanted to join an agency and work outdoors. Initially, my plan was to join the wildlife branch, but I realized that I would need more experience out in the field. And so I realized that I was a bit more qualified to work in the state parks. So after I got my degree in wildlife biology, I applied to work at Lake Mineral Wells State Park. I started there just cleaning toilets and occasionally helping up at the front desk and things like that. Then I joined the state park fire team, and I was still based out at Mineral Wells. We did all sorts of stuff, burn prep, herbicide applications, some wildfire responses. But I always wanted to do interpretation because I have a real passion for introducing people to new places, new ideas, and I applied to a whole lot of positions, and, well, the stars aligned at Mission Tejas. So,
nice.
That's my TED Talk on that.
All right. So what is your favorite memory at the park so far?
One of my favorite memories has got to be one of the fishing programs that I've put on here. We had a few college students out there camping in one of the nearby sites. When they saw me show up with all the fishing rods, they were interested, and so they tagged along, and one of them caught his first ever fish, and just the look on his face. Mm-hmm. College guy. It was his first ever fish that he caught, and of course, it turned out to be actually a pretty significantly sized bluegill, so that was really cool. I took his photo so he could show his buddies, and man, just the glow on the guy's face. And whenever you see a kid catch their first fish too, that's just that is such a special moment when you see a light kind of wake up, like you know that they just unlocked a very core memory, and it's just such an honor and a privilege to have been there just to see it, much less help facilitate it.
You know, it's funny, I asked that question, and I've probably had recorded about 13 state parks on so far the podcast, and every superintendent, park interpreter, that's always like their favorite memory, or, you know, a memory that they share is, it's always a visitor experiencing something for the first time. And even with Nikki, who was just on, it was an actual intern at the park. And, you know, them just saying, well, I've never seen this many stars before, because, you know, where they came from, all the light pollution and stuff just didn't facilitate those type of night skies. And yeah, it's funny hosting this podcast. You know, of course, the audio is going to be published, not the video. But even like watching you answer that question, you can see the sparkle in your eye that how meaningful that encounter was. And it's the same with all of them when they start to share these favorite moments, or, you know, memories that they have of visitors first. It's really cool to witness it for me as the host. So I guess the next question, it's already answered, but I don't know if it's something different, but what's the most rewarding part of working at Mission Tejas?
Yeah, it's definitely the visitors first. It's their first time catching a fish. It's their first time hearing an owl. It's the first time they do geocaching. It's the first watercolors that they've ever done. Their first time shooting a bow. It's all these memories that you are helping build for these people that they will carry with them. So yeah, it's feels good, man.
Nice. Yeah. And so this is an interesting question. So I'm going to let you answer this, and then I'm going to give my opinion on the park. So for someone who's never been, how would you describe Mission Tejas State Park?
So our state park, it's kind of like, at the risk of sounding nerdy, I would almost say it's almost like a matrix where the natural world and Texas history meet. There's so much, you know, we're out here in East Texas, and you're in East Texas, everyone thinks either pine forests or swamps. We don't really have a lot of swamps, but we got a lot of pine trees. But we also have a pretty varied ecosystem out here. There's hardwood bottomlands. We have a little riparian area where San Pedro Creek is. We have a tallgrass prairie up in the north part of the park. We have just a wide variety of different types of wildlife and trees and birds out here. But it's also a fantastic showcase of Texas history. You have echoes from everywhere, from pre-Columbian Native American times to Spanish exploration to the initial settlement of Texas by American settlers. You have leftovers and, you know, works that were built by the Civilian Conservation Corps in the Great Depression, and just stories and people passing through of every time in between. And even now, as you know, people visit the park and do all that, they are still adding to it, and we are still adding to it. The park, you know, when you're in parks and wildlife, especially in state parks, we like to talk about the resources of a site. We talk about natural resources in terms of fishing opportunities, bird watching opportunities, hiking trails, things like that. Then you talk about cultural resources such as historical markers, old hiking trails, social gathering places, things like that. This park, it's a place where nature and history seem to come together, and it certainly doesn't help that we have segments remnants of original El Camino Real out there, these ancient roads and trails that so many people have walked before. But even in other parks, you know, just the hiking trails that maybe they've only been there for like 30, 40 years, even those trails have history. So that is TLDR, I would say, Mission Tejas is where Texas history and East Texas wildlife meet. When you're out here and everything's quiet and the wind is sighing in the cottonwoods and the pines and the sugar maples, you hear eagles and wood ducks yodeling in the background, and you imagine wagon trains passing through on the old trails, you kind of have an experience where you feel you're not quite in the same time period. And it's a very, very special place. It certainly helps that we're pretty far from any major towns. So it really can help you get into that introspective area. That was a very long answer.
Hey, I love it. So I was looking around at just state parks. Maybe this was about 2 years ago around where I lived. And I saw Mission Tejas. And I want to say it's a good drive for me. It's almost, I don't know, 2.5-3 hours ish. If I remember correctly, I could be wrong, but it was a drive. And so I was kind of looking at the park and I'm like, oh, you know, definitely didn't really look at all the history until I got there, but just, you know, it seems pretty interesting. And, you know, we'll talk about more of the history here in a bit, but just taking that part out of it, I was shocked when I got to the park in a very awesome way. You guys have what, 12 or 13 trails? I mean, it's a lot. And so where I'm going with this, and I just want to kind of touch on just the hiking and backpacking aspect of it. So I believe when I was there, the main restrooms and stuff were closed. I think they were being renovated. So that part of the park was closed, but I day hiked the whole park. And if you're a new hiker, a new backpacker, or maybe you've been doing it for a while and you kind of want to elevate your comfort levels, meaning reading a map, like a paper map, dialing in your backpacking gear, you know, the primitive camps that you guys offer at Mission Tejas. I mean, it's I don't know, 10 minute walk or so, maybe 15 minute walk from where I parked. So you can really, in a safe environment, really test out, you know, reading a map and not worrying about getting lost, connecting trails. So, you know, I'm here and I want to do this trail and then connect to that trail and then hit this trail and then make a loop, you know, all from a paper map, building that comfort, you know, gear shakedown. You want to get into backpacking and you want a safe environment to park your car, get the backpack. And if something goes horribly wrong, you forgot your spork and you're not going to use a stick, you can just walk back to the car and grab it. So that was my initial impressions getting there. And also, like, there are sections of the park that are absolutely beautiful. And you said it, and I'm not going to butcher the name, but it's the north part of the park. It's like a cutout of the forest, and there's these yellow flowers that almost take up this whole area, and that's probably about an acre, I would guess. And it is absolutely beautiful. You have those, I think it's by the CCC bathtub. It's a section where you're right at that creek, but you know, you have some elevation gains and losses, and you know, you're walking along that creek. It's absolutely beautiful. So, you know, to the listeners, this is a park just from the hiking and backpacking aspect, you shouldn't pass up. Now, if you're a history buff, this park is all, it's going to give you every everything that you could ever want from a state park. So would you agree with my description of the park?
And that's a very apt description right there. And I'm really not going to argue against it, really.
All right. So kind of talking about the park and how, you know, the history of the park, can you share any stories or information about the original Spanish mission and its significance to the area?
Sure. How much time we got?
as long as you want.
All right. I'll try to do something a bit better than just the Cliff Notes version, but I'm not going to get too much into the weeds. Okay. So going back to the late 1600s, it's this part of Texas was part of the Spanish claim to the New World. It was part of the new Spanish Empire. Where we are right now was not particularly heavily populated at the time because there wasn't too many precious metals to be found out here. And it was also pretty close to French claims just on the east of the Sabine River. Well, lo and behold, what should happen to increase tensions between the Spanish and the French? That a French ship should crash land in Matagorda Bay, led by the explorer La Salle. And they created a settlement where they were hoping to get a bit of a foothold. I mean, they were probably quite a bit lost anyway. They were trying to, there's resources that say they were trying to find the Mississippi River, but several maps at the time show the Mississippi River in the Texas coast. They were still working out the kinks when it came to mapping out the region. Well, a Franciscan friar from Mexico, Damien Massenet, and also I'll put a little sidebar here. Sometimes reading our literature, people will read and it'll say Father Massenet or Father Damien Massenet. Well, he's part of the Franciscan order, which they probably would not have gone by father. It would have been brother or friar. Well, he actually heads over to the French settlement to check on the French clergy there to make sure that they have everything for their sacraments. They have communion wine, holy water, things like that. He gets there and he finds that the civilization has been largely abandoned and he only finds a few French boys left. And so he negotiates for their safe release back to France. But while he's down there, there's one Native American man who is from a people who is not from the coast. He walks up, he strikes his chest and says, "Tay Shas." Massenet thought he was describing his people. He thought he was saying that he was from the Tay Shas people. What he was actually saying is, "I'm an ally, I'm a non-combatant." So basically saying, "I mean you no harm." And eventually that would become the Spanish word Tejas. Now, eventually, when Massenet went back to Mexico, he told the governors out there about the presence of, you know, the French looking like they were going to establish themselves. And the Spanish had also received reports from several other very key Native American leaders along the Rio Grande. One such man's name was Sabieta, that what they called strange Spaniards were looking like they would encroach in Texas. And by strange Spaniards, they meant French and other European nations. So the Spanish realized they had to fortify their position on their northeast frontier. So Massenet and a very small contingent of Spanish soldiers, initially the governor wanted to send like 50 soldiers, but Massenet insisted they only needed like 5 because he figured these people would be peaceful. And for the most part, he was right. They head up to around this area and they establish Mission San Francisco de los Tejas, which is the mission of St. Francis for the Tejas people. Unfortunately, the mission only lasted about 3 years. Whenever European people and Native American peoples would meet among, you know, religious beliefs and languages and exchanging goods, one of the main things that is exchanged, unfortunately, is disease. In this case, a disease very similar, if not exactly, smallpox. The local tribe, which was a member of the Hassanai tribe, which they were a part of the Caddo people, they were devastated by the disease. And the Spanish realized they had to leave very quickly if they wanted to be able to leave of their own volition. So the friars burnt down the mission in the night, and eventually they made their way back. Eventually, Mission Tejas was reestablished, but under a different name in San Antonio with largely the same staffing. But that's the original mission.
The building, that the actual building, or is it a reconstruction of the building or what they thought the building would be or looked like?
So the mission that we have in the middle of the park currently was actually built by Company 888 of the Civilian Conservation Corps during the Great Depression. The plans for construction began in 1934, and it took, they built it during the summer too. So it was like during the hottest part of the year, or at least it was completed.
Horse in flies.
Yeah, horse flies, all sorts of loveliness, plenty of copperheads around, I'm sure. But it is not meant to be a replica. For one thing, it's not the right fashion. Boys at the CCC, they didn't know what a mission at the time would have looked like, and they didn't have any drawings. So basically, kind of has a Lincoln log cabin kind of vibe to it. But an original Spanish mission at the time would have been constructed of timber and surrounded by a palisade, or palisado is what they would have called, a lot of vertical timbers. A lot of missions would start off being built out of wood, just in case something like what happened with the original Mission Tejas happens. Sometimes things just don't pan out. It's easier to cut your losses with a timber building than cut your losses with a very expensive and costly stone construction.
And I know you mentioned earlier about the El Camino. How does that tie into all this?
So El Camino Real is basically, it's a road system that has had many, many different names. It started off as game trails that Native Americans would use to do trade and commerce between themselves. The Caddo, most people know the Caddo as agricultural people, or maybe they know them for the mound building or worshiping their moon god Nish. But one thing that people, I personally feel like people are not quite giving the Caddo enough credit for, was also the commerce that they were able to work with. They were able to get supplies not just from the Texas coast, but there's evidence to show that they were able to get resources all the way from the Great Lakes with the trade routes that were established. So they used these trade routes. When the Spanish come up, they further developed the trails and they mapped them out. In fact, when a vague map of El Camino Real was shown to the very first governor over in Mexico City, he looked at it and scoffed, and he said, "Only a sleepwalker could have constructed such a road." That's also because El Camino changed, and today, I guess in a way, still changes, is because eventually, American settlers would come down that way, and as wagon trains were used on it, it would actually create so many ruts in El Camino Real, especially in the wet areas, that a lot of the Teamsters that went from Nacogdoches to Crockett when it was first being developed, they used to boast that, "I know the route from Nacogdoches to Crockett, forwards, backwards, and 6 feet under." But over time, after Texas gained its independence from Mexico, it was mostly renamed Old San Antonio Road. You'll still see OSR on several areas. And Highway 21, basically all the way from Austin past Nacogdoches, still follows a very large segment of original El Camino Real. But here at the park, we actually have a few sections of El Camino, the main ones mostly being up in the prairie, the Navadachi Prairie that you had mentioned. The two main swells that we have running parallel to each other are along the south side of that.
Yeah, I think that's where I stumbled across it and was reading about it, and I was like, I can't believe that. I don't remember how far it dated back, but it was a long time ago.
Centuries, maybe even longer.
Yeah, absolutely. So, speaking of history and the park, are there any other historical landmarks that you think are of value to visitors?
Absolutely. There's lots more. At the time of this podcast, we are still undergoing construction at the moment. So the commemorative mission and the original El Camino Real swells are not visitable right now. But one thing that is still available for people to see is the Rice family log home. That is another major historical feature that we have. It is an excellent example of 19th century pioneer homes. It's not a log cabin. A lot of people say it's a log cabin. It's not. A log cabin was a temporary residence, mostly made of rounded logs that still had bark on them. A log home, all the planks, all the bark was removed to help facilitate equal drying out to make sure that no insects were in there. And they were considered a bit more, I guess, respectable is the term for it. It was definitely more intended for pioneers that had large families who intended to stay put. And the story of the Rice home, that's a whole podcast episode in itself. But
okay,
to basically wrap it up and sum it up, basically from the 1820s to the 1830s, one major pioneer family that passed through what is now Houston County, they constructed this log home. The patriarch of this branch of the family, his name was Joseph Redmond Rice. He was a Tennessean man, and he married into a Kentucky family known as the Masters, and his wife was Willie Masters. And they constructed the log home, which was right on El Camino Real. It used to be a lot closer to Crockett. It was about 17 and a half miles west of here. But it was so perfectly situated that it became something of a stagecoach inn. And throughout the latter half of the 1800s, plenty of people would actually stay at the home on their way to Crockett. And we do a lot of programs out there. We talk about the history of the family and how log homes were constructed in the history of all that and how they would have lived life. We show it has it's actually one of the only standing log homes that has both a dog trot and a saddleback, which is not many standing log homes today have both of those.
The log home is pretty spectacular, but I actually got spooked when I was hiking, and I got to get the story for this, but I rounded a corner and I started to see there was an old chimney standing with the spooky swing set that is missing the swing. And I was like, oh my gosh. So it's, yeah, you walk up. Maybe there was a gate that you kind of walk through, but there was like a little front yard with a old swing set. That's just the kind of the bars, the swing parts are gone. And then the only thing remaining is just the fireplace, the chimney. So yeah. And I was like, oh, okay, this is creepy.
So, that is yet another historical landmark we have. We could go on and on about all the history out in the park. So that is actually the remains of the Lucas Homestead that was on our Chimney Loop Trail, I take it. Well, that's the chimney. it was a family out in Crockett, I believe. We're still getting the details on this. It's kind of a newer piece of property for the park, and we're still getting the historical narrative for a lot of it. But basically, a family wanted to have a goat farm out there north of the park property, and they actually brought in several goats. There used to be one goat, actually, that hung out around the San Pedro Creek, who apparently was very infamous for biting people. That little rotating door thing that are right by the benches over there. So one possibility of that, that we believe is the family would have hung kind of glass bottles and things from there, and light passing through that and the clanging and all that was actually meant to keep goats away from the house itself. Unfortunately, Lucas himself, he eventually passed away, and his widow, she didn't really want the property, especially after a fire actually broke out and burnt down almost all the entire house except for the swing set, the potential anti-goat system, and the chimney. There actually still is, there's still the cornerstones of the original house there, and you can actually see how large the original home would have been. But that's a bit more recent history. We got that property around the 1990s, actually. So that's a bit more of a recent acquisition added to the park's already expansive history.
Yeah, I was really spooked out, and of course I walked through it all. But man, I couldn't imagine if that swing set had the little swing, like an aged swing, I would have ran. So speaking of trails, how many miles of trail does Mission Tejas offer to visitors?
So one thing, I will preface this by saying, so our literature often says that we have about 12 miles of trails, but one thing we're actually in the process of doing is we are going to be kind of using GPS locations to take a look and make absolutely sure that number is correct. So we are currently working on GPSing the trails, especially since some of the trails have actually changed. While we were doing construction on the roads and all that, we've also been kind of adding a few things here and there on some of the trails. One of them has a new route. And so because of that, don't really know if the 12 miles standby still stands, if that's changed or how much that has changed. So that is something we're working on, but it is still it's a considerable distance.
Yeah, my guess, and I didn't go through and calculate, it would be between 12 and 15 miles. It's made up of a lot of small trails. So I think for beginners, for families, it's absolutely perfect park. You have some exciting, beautiful things, as well as, like, I tried to day hike the whole thing. And, you know, so if for people that kind of want to push it a little bit, it also offers, you know, that type of activity. In your opinion, what terrain can hikers expect in the park?
So for East Texas, our park is actually, the terrain of the park actually varies significantly. When you first drive into the park, you're actually at the highest point, because the further down into the park you go, there are many drainages that carry water north towards San Pedro Creek, and that in turn flows east eventually into the Neches River. So as you go further north in the park, it generally tends to all go down. We don't have very many extremely flat trails, actually. I would say the flattest trail we have is definitely the Navidache Loop around the prairie in the very far north. That's by far the flattest trail we have. Most of the park, there's quite a bit of up and down, you know, steep ravine, Carl Lovett, steep step trail, which I think the name kind of lets you know already what you're in for with that. Cemetery Hill, even the very western end of Weech's Run, all those can get kind of steep. And we actually have a lot of people, their steep ravine trail is one of the only trails that is still open right now. We've had plenty of people who are preparing to hike Colorado. We've had some people, they go to Scotland sometimes, and they like to hike steep ravine trail because of the different changes in elevation. For here in East Texas, it's pretty significant because most of East Texas is kind of flat.
So what would you say are some of the most popular trails in the park?
Well, Steep Ravine is actually what I would say. Steep Ravine is one of our most popular trails for day use visitors, like people who are visiting the playground and things like that. They really like to visit the Tejas Timber Trail because it also circles our fishing pond. And so people are wetting a line in there quite a bit. And for those who are more interested in wildlife or natural diversity, quite a few people like Navadache Loop because it's so unique compared to a lot of the forested areas of the park.
And to the listeners, for you'll see a trail called Cemetery Hill. There is a cemetery to the outskirts of the park. It's not in the park. It's not an old cemetery. It's a modern cemetery. But if you're camping and you want to walk by a cemetery at night, there you go.
It's the Weeches Cemetery. It's the local community's cemetery. It's actually one of their one of the local community's most treasured areas. A lot of the people here every year, they actually meet up every year to discuss maintenance of the trail. And anyone who lives in this little community that our park is around, a lot of times they will come back specifically for the Weeches Cemetery homecoming. And they will all meet up, they'll have a meal, and they will, you know, visit the graves of loved ones there. The Cemetery Hill Trail is on the other side of some trees where you can pass the cemetery. Whistling is not necessary, but you do you. If you feel the need to do that as you walk by, that is up to you. But it's pretty nice.
Yeah. So do you have a personal favorite trail in the park?
Well, I had said Hardwood was one of my favorites just because it's at the very bottom that runs right next to the creek bed, and there's such different trees out there, and there's actually quite a few owls that like to hang out around there. Although I do also have a soft spot for Tejas Timber, particularly when we have a nice wet fall and the trees are these dazzling colors. It doesn't help or it doesn't hurt that there might be some decent sized bass in there. I'm just saying.
All right. So in your opinion, are there any hidden gems or lesser known spots in the park that you think visitors often miss?
We got one trail called the San Pedro Spur that basically the best way to access it is parking at the mission. And it juts straight north right next to a creek towards the Navadache Loop. There is a massive sugar maple grove that grows right in the middle of it. And on wet falls, this fall is not looking like it's very lush. Let's just say that there's a few maples here, unfortunately, that have just already, they said, no, I'm done. And they just dropped all their leaves already, unfortunately, but there's always next year. But when they retain their leaves, there's just this golden canopy that just hangs above, and they hold on to their leaves a bit longer than other trees usually. And it's just gorgeous. If anyone listening is a fan of Tolkien in Lord of the Rings, it's a veritable Lothlorien, but they're not as impressive as the Mallards there. There is one other thing though. One thing about the park that not many people know about is the fact that at night, especially on really cool winter nights without a moon, the stargazing is phenomenal, especially really? Around Navadache. Yes, it's actually, you wouldn't know this, but we're so far from a lot of the other towns that the stars are very clear, especially on cold nights without a moon. It's just breathtaking. I've done some stargazing programs out here, and people are always shocked by just how clear they are out here.
I would have never guessed, but that's awesome. Mm-hmm. So what kind of wildlife should visitors expect in the park? And that wraps up another exciting episode of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. We hope you enjoyed the episode today and stay tuned for our next episode where we will pick back up where we left off and guarantee to uncover many more hiking gems and share many more tips to enhance your experience on the trail. Until then, happy trails and happy hiking.